You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Good evening, everyone. This is Rico Muhammad coming to you live from Atlanta, Georgia. Tonight, we have a very, very special guest on with us tonight. If you guys have been reading and catching up with our post on Facebook, we are honored to have Mr. Henry Seaton, the author of Protecting Motor Carriers' Interest in Contracts. We have him on board with us tonight, so we're going to break from our normal and traditional format. I want us to be able to have as much time as we possibly can with Mr. Seaton since we only have a one-hour show tonight. So if you have any questions pertaining to anything with the transportation industry, go ahead and press the number one so we can get you in queue and get you right on board so that you can ask your question to Mr. Seaton himself. And with that said, with no further ado, we want to bring on our special guest, Mr. Henry Seaton. And let's see if we can get him up here. Mr. Seaton, are you there?
I am here.
All right. Well, we got you plugged in, locked and loaded. So
okay, let's go.
Yes, sir. So we're gonna wait to see if we can get a couple of callers queued up and get them get everybody online to press the number one to get in queue to ask your question. So initially, I guess I'm going to start out with a couple of questions just to get, you know, last time we had you on, we were going to try to go through the 12 deadly contract clauses. I think we maybe only got to about two or three of them. But
I think we didn't get much progress.
Yeah. But one of the hot button topics that, of course, that I think that a lot of people want to have a question pertaining to is how do they handle and deal with the issue of detention when they run into a problem on a brokered load, and how is the rate determined? Who negotiates what? There seems to be a lot of gray area, a lot of fog surrounding it. Now, maybe you can try to help clear it up for some of the callers on the line tonight.
Yeah, the issue of detention is a crucial one. The best time to take care of any of those problems is before you accept the load. The larger carriers, of course, enter into long-term contracts, and those contracts have provisions usually for as much as 2 hours to unload, but then detention's paid. Traditionally, carriers in the spot market haven't had a whole lot of negotiating room, and they have pretty much showed up and tried to get unloaded, and then when detention got bad, they called the property broker only to have him say, "I haven't got anything in it, pound sand," and then you get in an arguing contest, and that's not very becoming. The carrier, of course, has a lien on the load for the payment of the detention, but one man's lien's another man's hijack. If you haven't gotten it straight beforehand, things can get really very ugly. And I think that increasingly sophisticated brokers are understanding that they have to pay for detention. And I would just say that you get it, the best thing to do is to get it straight up front when you're asked to sign a load confirmation sheet. You should inquire about the unloading practices at the consignee. Is it live unload? What are the business hours? And if you can get it on the load confirmation sheet, 2 hours free or whatever it is, and then the detention after that. I'm seeing a lot of brokers, a lot of people in contracts try to come up with what I consider to be very inadequate detention, and want to say, we pay a maximum of $100 a day or something like that. And it's really a negotiating thing. It's business turns good. You're going to be able to accept or reject loads, and if someone's not willing to provide you with detention, you probably need to think about turning down the load. I have represented people in this situation in which, the shipper says come back in 2 weeks, and I've told the guy to say I'm not going to do that. I'm going to put it in storage, and you can pay the storage bill when you get it out, but I'm not going to wait around here for that. That wasn't part of the deal. The old rule used to be that the carrier should be unloaded upon arrival during ordinary business hours, and this whole issue of detention came into effect when just-in-time inventorying came in, and every shipper thought that he didn't want to pay for an extra shift of the people to unload trucks, so he'd tell you you had to keep an appointment at 5:02, and if you didn't get there, you could come back in 2 hours. And that's really abusive. I think there is going to be an effort as the years go by to get the shippers involved in that. The agency's trying to get authority over them, particularly with respect to telling a driver he has to keep a delivery appointment or go sit on it for the weekend. I have mixed views about the government getting involved in it and specifying detention, but I think there will be certainly efforts to enforce that, because a man in the truck can't sit and wait. People have to get off of this inventory control situation and be available to unload you when you get there, I figure. But legally, the best way to take care of it is incorporating the contract on the front end.
And what about the issue as far, well, not necessarily an issue, but I heard there was a question about, is there a specific law that states days to pay? Like if you happen to deal, I know that sometimes in the contract that with brokers, they spell out how long that, you know, with 30 days or whatever, if you're extending credit. But if you're dealing with a direct shipper or something like that, is there something maybe in the CARMAC rules or anything like that that spells out specifically?
No, there is an old rule that's still on the books that says that invoices should be rendered and should be paid on 15 days. But there's no teeth in that. You got the right to insist on 15 days, but unless you get into the contract a provision for interest and attorney's fees, you're basically giving an interest-free loan to the shipper or the broker if he decides that he's got a case of the shorts and would rather pay his bank or his heat, lights, and water than that carrier he's never going to see again. So it is a question of negotiating it. It is a question of, your best remedy, if you've got somebody who's just notoriously slow, is to report them to one of the credit services, Ansonia or First Advantage or someone that they'll quickly lose their panache if they don't pay their carriers on time. I'm seeing in some shipper contracts actually 60 and 90 days, and I'm certainly advocating that my clients tell those shippers to go pound sand because, the motor carrier industry is just runs on too tight a margin to be kind of extending that kind of credit to shippers. And moreover, the more money you extend in credit, the harder the fall will be if they go bankrupt.
Right, right. And one of the things that I noticed that you spoke on earlier about the insurance, they got this new provision coming up where they're trying to increase the insurance minimums for the motor carriers out here. You got any? You got a take on that? And before I let you get into that, just want to remind all the callers, if you have a question for Mr. Seaton, go ahead and press number one. We're not going to have an extended show tonight. We only have 1 hour, so if you got questions, press number one, get in line, and we'll get you right up. Okay, Mr. Seaton, what's your take on that?
Well, with respect to the insurance levels, I would certainly be an advocate for holding the existing levels of insurance. I think there is inside the Washington Beltway guys some sort of a trade-off that there's going to be great pressure from the agency and the plaintiff's bar to increase the amount. There may be at some point a real fight to get it up to 2 million. I think that will have an anti-competitive effect. I think small carriers will need to make their case, particularly to the Tea Party congressman, that that it is anti-competitive. I think that part of our argument is to say you can be just as dead if a four-wheeler runs over you. And most of those guys don't have $40,000 worth in insurance. But obviously the argument is pretty strong that the amount of insurance required from a carrier hasn't been changed in, what, 30 or 40 years, and that, you know, the $750,000 doesn't go nearly as far as it did. Whether or not that becomes involved in this whole question, carrier's liability, whether somebody trades off, let's raise the insurance a bit and stop the liability for accidents with the carrier so that the plaintiffs don't have a cause of action against shippers and brokers, I could see that happening. I think that there's a tendency among the larger carriers who basically have to have more than $750,000 to protect their assets. They figure, well, they've got a competitive disadvantage because they've got to maintain more than $750,000, and small carrier, you know, doesn't have the same obligation. So if they're looking at it from a competitive advantage point of view, you're not going to get a whole lot of support for keeping a low minimum level from a guy who's got 1,400 trucks. And, you know, he may be better organized politically than the small guys. So I think small people need to be heard on that. It's in the agency agenda. They've got a wish list that they've sent over to Congress that I guess will be considered now sometime in the spring, and increasing the amount of the insurance is one of their issues. Clearly, if this is my political input for the night, those of you who are in battleground states, if the Senate turns red, your chances of keeping the existing limits a whole lot better.
Okay. Good stuff. Well, I got a question that's near and dear to me, one thing that we've been discussing a lot and kind of kicking the idea around. Just want to remind everybody, I see there's a bunch of callers online. This is a perfect opportunity to ask a transportation attorney if you have any questions. Now is a perfect opportunity. I got a bunch of callers online. It looks like everybody's being shot tonight, Mr. C. But one of the things that we've been throwing around, and they kind of took it away, I think, under the new MAP 21 when they took away the ability for motor carriers to do the interlining agreements. If you say, like, I'll just paint a broad picture. Say if I have a buddy of mine that stays in Dallas, Texas, and he has some customers out there, and I stay in Atlanta, Georgia, and I've got customers here in Atlanta, Georgia, and we wanted to maybe do something where we could do just like a turnaround run, and he would give me, you know, when I'm in Dallas, he'd turn his customers over to me, and I could run interline for him and vice versa in Atlanta. I think they kind of, you know, did away with us the ability for us to be able to do that under the new laws and regulations.
I was adamantly against that new law. I think that the trucking interest got hooked and snookered by the brokers when it came in. I don't think that anybody began to understand the importance of small carriers being able to get access to, like you say, their buddy, in order
right.
for a small carrier not to have to broker every load. He's ultimately going to have to get a hometown shipper, and that hometown shipper is going to need to not just call him for one load, he's going to need to call him for two or three. And, you know, anything that makes it tough for him to get excess capacity in the spot market is anti-competitive, and that part of MAP 21 should be repealed. There is an effort to do that. There are 25 state associations, three divisions of ATA, and the trade associations that I represent that would like to see Congress address that. And you know, among the associations that are supporting doing something for that is the California Trucking Association, the ag haulers, the intermodal carriers, and the little trade associations that I work with, NASDIC among them. Whether
right.
or not that piece of legislation will get any traction, I don't know. The way it's written now, what is precluded is truckload, origin to destination brokerage by a carrier unless they have a broker's license or a freight forwarder permit. There is a potential way around a portion of that, and that is what's called joint line service is still available. If you, Muhammad, picked a load up in South Carolina, and you picked it up even with your buddy's trailer, and gave it to him, down the road 10 miles. That would be a joint line service, and you would not have to have a broker's license to do that. So, I mean, that's a bit of a loophole, but it is being used by some people who, let's say, have a plant, or let's say they got 15 trucks in a drop yard across the street from a major plant.
Right.
They can very well have a buddy spot a trailer there, go over, pick up the loaded trailer, bring it back to their lot, a joint line bill at their lot, and then get it moved on down the road. That takes a bit more pre-planning, and it takes having assets at either the origin or destination, but that's still doable.
Okay. Well, I guess I don't pride at my listeners enough. We got some callers on the line this evening, so I'm going to shut up and give them an opportunity to get a chance to talk to you. We're going to go to Rochester,
okay.
New York. We have George in Rochester, New York. Let's see if we can get him online. George, are you there?
Hey, Rico, Mr. Seaton, how are you guys doing tonight?
Doing fine, George.
Hey, the
doing
increased
well,
liability that they're proposing or requesting with MAP 21 is for general liability, not for cargo liability, correct?
The increase in liability is for what we call BINPD. It's your automobile liability. It's the one that you probably got a minimum of $750,000. There is
correct.
No cargo insurance requirement. There is
okay,
none.
Okay, my question is regarding cargo insurance, because next month I am going to increase my cargo insurance from $100,000 to $250,000 due to some of the things that I do. Now, does that mean all of my shipments will be covered at $250,000, or if a customer says to me, oh, well, I want more than $100,000 like everyone else, can I market that as another benefit of my business?
There are two things about insurance that you need to understand. Number one, in most broker or shipper contracts, they will say that you must have a minimum of $100,000 or $250,000 depending upon the value of their shipment. But under what we call the Carmack Amendment, unless you limit your liability, the amount of insurance you say you have doesn't limit your exposure. So, for example, if you sign a broker contract that says you've got to have a minimum of $100,000, but you don't also put in the contract that your maximum liability for cargo loss or damage is $100,000, they can give you a $500,000 load, and if it gets stolen, your $100,000 doesn't end your exposure. So the first thing, and I know I'm getting a little beyond your question, is everybody on the line needs to be very careful when they sign a broker or shipper contract to get into the contract that their maximum limit of liability is whatever they want it to be. Now, let's assume that you've got $250,000 worth of insurance. That doesn't mean that you can't put on a load confirmation sheet that your maximum liability is $100,000, your insurance company would be very, very happy if you did that. But having the $250,000 then does allow you to sign on to some higher value loads. And I agree that there is a set point. They did a study of cargo values back in the late 80s, maybe mid-90s, and they said then that 85% of the truckload cargo moved off at $100,000 or less. My guess is with inflation, it's probably closer to 65%. So I'm seeing a lot of spending on the commodities, people insisting that, you know, you have $250,000, particularly when they're dealing with a small carrier, because their fear is if there is an insurance, a small carrier is not going to be able to pay, you know, a judgment over $100,000.
Okay, so having said that, I don't, you know, you mentioned about rate confirmations and such. I do very little broker freight. Most everything I do is direct. So should I get more in a habit of doing formal quotes? I mean, I quote a great deal of my stuff. Some is verbal. Some is just email. Should I do formal quotes and just put a line item in there? Maximum liability on this shipment is $100,000 or whatever I choose?
Yeah. What happens is I think it's good practice to do it one of two ways. Either use a load confirmation sheet, which acknowledges, you know, if you get one from a shipper, if it's a repeat shipper and you don't have a contract with him, we can do for you a very, depending on your size, a very simple website terms and conditions that you can put the name of your trucking company and, you know, your standard terms and conditions. And they can be all the way from 2 pages to 43 pages. But once you have those terms and conditions, you put on your load confirmation sheet and on everything you sign, subject to service terms and conditions found at george/rochester.com. And then you will be incorporating into your load your standard holding out. Now, what I'm telling you to do is exactly what happens when you, if you book a load with Roadway or one of the LTL carriers, because they've always had service terms and conditions. And that's the way to enforce it through your website. If you don't, what happens is a lot of guys, let's say that are heavy haulers, hauling machinery and things like that, they will put on their load confirmation sheet, this is, 15,532 with a note, shipment agreed maximum value is X. And depending upon the what you're handling, I think it's imperative that you get into the shipping document what your limit of liability is, because otherwise it's a spiral of death if you got $100,000 and all of a sudden you don't know, but that shipment is a high value. The thieves may know.
I was going to jump in real quick right here, Mr. Seaton. I just want to, because I know you're much too humble to do it, but I just want to plug Mr. Seaton's book again, Protecting Motor Carrier's Interest and Contract. And if you have that book, in the back of that section, there's actually a sample carrier shipper load confirmation sheet in the back of that book. So it's a valuable tool. If you don't have that book, go to transportationlaw.net and go ahead and place an order in for Mr. Seaton's book. He was humble and gracious enough to come and join us on the call. And, okay, George, you got anything else? I'm gonna shut up now.
Yeah, no, perfect. I want to follow up on that. But it's funny, you know, Mr. Seaton, you mentioned about the LTL world, and I spent many years, 16 years in LTL sales, and you had issues with customers that had claims. And they're like, well, I didn't know you only covered 50 cents a pound. And I was like, well, it's in our rural tariff. It's on. You know, I remember saying to some person, you ever read the back of the bill of lading? They were like, I don't have time for that. And I'm like, well, maybe you should have made time.
Yeah, and the thing is that I don't believe in trying to ambush anybody about it. It's not a question of putting on some obscure website and don't tell the guy that there's a limitation of liability. But I have seen far too many small clients go out of business because they didn't bother to inquire, and then they had a huge loss. I've got a client here in Tennessee that I won't use the name of the major broker, but the broker doesn't bother to tell the carrier how expensive the goods are on the truck, because they figure that, well, gee, we just keep him dumb and happy until there's a theft. And, you know, now they're all upset because the small carrier set down the trailer in an unguarded lot. Well, if he'd known that load was worth $750,000, I think he'd probably guard it a little bit. And, you know, if nothing else, putting on the load confirmation sheet that, you know, maximum liability is $100,000 will let you know before the load is absconded with, you know, that you got a high value load and you better not set it down on an unguarded lot.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, George, you good?
So I'm good. I could go on, but I'm not going to. And you'll get to some of these others. And thank you very much.
Sure.
All right, George. We appreciate the call. Let's go to Joel. Joel has a question. Let's see. Joel, are you there?
I'm here. Hello?
Hello, Joel. Yes, yes,
yes,
sir.
I'm here. My question is, a lot of the broker agreements, the broker can either be the certificate of insurance holder, or some of the agreements ask to be added as an additional insured on the certificate. Now, how can that doing that affect me?
Well, you know, adding a guy as an additional insured, and in fact, if you go to my website, I did a webinar for IT Magazine on additional insured versus certificate holder, and you can probably download the PowerPoint because it's not very easy to describe. A certificate holder only gets on an accord the right to maybe be notified. He doesn't have the right to see the policy, and he doesn't necessarily get notice when it's changed. Someone who's an additional insured has certain rights under the policy, the biggest right being that he gets notice of it. Brokers sometimes figure that in addition to the fact that they get notice, now can insist that the insurance company offer them a defense. And they may get some additional rights if you've got a flaky insurance company that wants to deny the claim. We have situations in which particularly a small motor carrier will get a flaky insurance company, not even know what the exclusions are. And then when the claim is filed, the insurance company says, well, Mr. Broker, we've got a coverage issue. We're not providing a defense. Go pound sand. And in those kinds of situations, it helps a broker to say, not so fast. I'm insured under the policy. I want to see the policy. I want to see the basis under which you're denying the claim. So that's part of the reason that some of the brokers ask for additional insured language. And there's a real problem here. Particularly with cargo insurance, because all cargo insurance is not equal, and I have some broker clients who are really very frustrated by the poor claims handling activities they get out of certain insurance companies who won't be named. And there's no easy way like there is with liability insurance. Since the government doesn't give you any endorsement, doesn't give you any protection, that certificate of insurance alone doesn't give you much.
Okay, so is this something I should stay away from?
Well, you know, it's a pain in the tush to get somebody named as an additional insured for an individual load. You know, I think a lot of times what will happen is your agent will issue a certificate to them saying they're an additional named insured, additional insured. Whether they really are, I don't know. I wouldn't say that it hurts you at all to name somebody as an additional insured. It's just a bit of a hassle. Okay. And, you know, I'd be interested to see what kind of pushback you got from your insurance company.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. We got Mark has a question about liability. Let's go to Mark. Mark, you're on with Mr. Seaton.
Thank you for the call, answering the call. I was leased to a carrier earlier this year, and I was in a DOT accident, and I had a $1,000 escrow, and they took out what was due on standard deductions, and the balance of like $600, they wrote on the settlement accident liability. Is that legal to just take the rest of the escrow and call it?
Well, your owner-operator lease has to specify with particularity what can be deducted from your final settlement. Now, you mentioned deductible. Sometimes what will be in an owner-operator lease will be a provision that says that the owner-operator will be liable to the carrier for any deductible that the carrier has to suffer as a result of a loss. So the $600, if you can track it to some right that they had in the owner-operator lease, then it's legal. If it's just some made-up deduction, then you've got a basis not only to sue them but also to get your attorney's fees. Now, doing that over $600 is not something that I think is very profitable. But very clearly, if you are ending an owner-operator lease with somebody and you don't get an accounting on your escrow that you can track back to something you agreed to as a set-off or deduction, then you've got every right to say, please send me my $600 or show me in the lease where you're authorized to make the deduction.
All right. Thank you for your advice.
All right. Thank you, Mark, for the phone call. Let's jump over here. We got Thomas on the line, wants to know about insurance requirements and carrier agreements. Thomas, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Rico. Thanks. Mr. Seaton, thanks for taking my call. Previous or the second person before me had asked about the named insured topic, and that was covered in great detail, and I appreciate that. And I had kind of a related question. A lot of our carrier agreements and broker contacts will ask for that. And to tell you the truth, I just don't offer that and issue them a standard certificate. And if they accept that and issue a load confirmation, am I exposed to any extraordinary consequences by doing that?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You're required, and you know, as I tried to explain to the earlier caller, I don't think you're giving up a whole lot by naming them as an additional insured. It certainly doesn't affect your rights and remedies other than the hassle factor, and I'm not sure that, brokers will ask. I'm not sure how many loads you'd lose if you just said, hey, buddy, I can get you a cert. But, I can't get you a certificate of additional insured status here today. It's going to take me a while, and I don't really think you need it. You're perfectly free to go call my agent if you want, because I really don't see that as being that operative. I do think that the broker and the shipper has a right to know that your insurance is for real. Let me give you an example. A lot of cargo insurance is sold on a specified unit basis, and sometimes that specified unit is not disclosed on the accord certificate. And, you know, nothing frustrates a broker any more than to hire you to move a shipment, and then there is a loss, and the insurance comes back and says, well, our cargo policy only applied to a 2006 Volvo when this accident was on a 2012 International. It's those kinds of problems that leads shippers and brokers to cast around to be sure the insurance is valid. You know, they have got rights under the policy only indirectly. If I'm a broker and you haul a load for me, I can't go sue your insurance company direct. I've got to sue you, get a judgment, and if your insurance company didn't defend, then I've got to take that judgment and turn around and sue the insurance company. And let's face it, that's pretty poor practice. You know, your insurance company needs to be somebody who will step up to the bar, defend you, and pay a claim that there's a valid one, rather than a broker having to clutch it. And that's the problem that they're facing. And I don't think it's that they're trying to be unreasonable to probe what kind of insurance you've got. I don't think it should be a material issue for you. I don't know how many loads you'd lose if you said I'm not going to give you an additional insurance certificate. As a fairly sophisticated guy in the industry, I'd want to say, well, who's your insurance with? And I can probably tell by that, get a good idea from that, whether or not I want to do business with you.
Sure. And you know, I think the number of loads that I've lost because of just sending a certificate is zero. So,
yeah.
You know, apparently it's not really a sensitive issue with them, or perhaps the carrier that I'm insured by is satisfactory enough. I don't know. I just, you've answered my main question, which is, you know, am I exposing myself to potential claims or liability by refusing to offer named insured status?
Is a lengthy webinar. I think it's even with audio. On my website, which is transportationlaw.net. So I think the audio was recorded, and I think you can get free access to that. And you know, I'm not sure it'll be a whole lot clearer, but it's all I could find out about additional insured status.
That answers my question. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call again, Thomas. And we're going to jump over and we're going to grab Gary. Gary, we're on the road with this insurance, Mr. Seaton. Gary has a question about officially insured as well.
Yeah,
okay.
I was told that if you had a broker added as an additional insured or additional policyholder, that they could make a claim against that insurance without you even knowing it. And also that they could make changes like increasing your limits.
Oh, Lord. No.
Without you knowing it.
No, that's not true. What they get is the difference between additional insured and additional named insured. But every policy has a primary insured. And there's no way that you can confer any kind of status on him that lets him increase your premium or change your coverage. I think that's just very simply a myth.
Okay.
And, actually, with respect to cargo, it's not additional insured status, it's lost payee status. Because, you know, the way cargo policy is written, it's written for the benefit of the custodian of the cargo, and you're the custodian of the cargo, the broker isn't. So correctly seen, I think that a broker might ask for being a lost payee. And sometimes the reason they'll ask to be a lost payee is because they don't want the insurance company to send the carrier the money, and then the carrier go out of business and not forward it to them. So there's a difference there, but I think what you said is an urban. They can't change the terms of policy. They just get subsidiary rights.
Not even depending on what the state law is for that state.
No, it's not a matter of state. It's not a matter of state law.
Okay.
No, at best on a auto liability policy, what could happen is, let's assume that let's assume that you're involved in an auto accident, and your insurance company owes you a defense. And let's assume that they also sue the broker. Well, if the broker is an additional insured under your policy, your insurance company can't go out and settle for less than the policy limit and leave the broker there exposed. Okay? So, you know, from the broker's point of view, then he's an additional insured under the policy, and your insurance company, which has got the primary obligation, settle the accident because you're the one that hit the plaintiff. The insurance company owes them a defense and has got to pay up to the policy limit to extinguish that obligation. So that's what they're after. They want to be sure that, you know, your obligation, which is to indemnify the shipper against your negligence, is fully satisfied, because there have been cases in which an insurance company would go in and settle your claim for $200,000, walk away, wash their hands of it and leave the shipper or the broker hanging loose. And that's why the shipper or broker wants to make sure that they're getting the benefits of the limits of your insurance. Does that make sense?
Okay, yeah.
But beyond that, they can't mess with your premium or your coverage.
Oh, okay.
Just making them more of a beneficiary of your policy rather than just giving them notice.
Right, right now I've got like probably 35 contracts out with brokers, and you know, I think I've got three of that one that have asked to be additional insurance. And I've even had one that called the insurance company and told them that they wanted to be added. They circumvented me and went straight to the insurance company. And the insurance agent called me, and I told them no.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can't call up and say, I want to be added on a man's insurance policy. It's his policy. He's got a grant permission.
Right.
But even if they were added, they are only going to get the benefit of the policy to the extent that your act of negligence causes them harm. They're not going to get coverage for anything they might do, and they're not going to get any benefits that you probably don't owe them anyway. And you know, the other thing is with respect to your BI and PD, there's always the BMC 91X that's here to basically tell the plaintiff that, why she settles cheap with your insurance company and go sue the broker. He's got every incentive to get, if his plaintiff has got $1 million worth of injuries, to want $1 million from you, not take less.
Right. And just want to remind, we got a bunch of new callers that just joined us. We got about 15 minutes left in the show. If you want to get a question in with Mr. Seaton, go ahead and press #1 to get in the queue. With that said, we're going to jump right back into the questions. Mr. Seaton, we're going to go to Orlando, Florida, and get Ken. Ken, are you there?
I'm here, Rico. How are you guys doing tonight? I had a quick question. I'm a big advocate for getting direct customers, but so far most of what I've done is kind of a verbal agreement with a handshake, and it hasn't bitten me in the butt yet, but I do think that I need to be a little more careful and get something in writing going forward. And most of what I've done is just, one-time load, spot market type stuff, and I am shopping, trying to solicit more long-term customers. What types of things should be included in a contract? And I guess I'm a little, when I sign on with a broker or something like that, I sign one of their contracts, some of those are 15 or 20 pages long, and some of it is just looks like would never apply type of scenarios, but I know they want to cover all of their bases. Is that something I should be worried about, covering every little tiny detail
that? Rico's plugged my book. I guess I'm going to plug it. If you're looking at doing that, you can go on the web. and I think download it for less than $30. But there are provisions in there that talk about what is what are standard terms that you see in broker carrier agreements. There's what we call the Dirty Dozen, which is what we started to cover last time, which are 12 provisions that usually show up in contracts, how they try to get into your pocket and how you can modify it. And then, as Rico mentioned, there are little one- or two-page contracts that distill down the essence of what is the rules of the road. And they're really pretty basic, that you're licensed, authorized, and insured, that, you know, you warrant that you have got cargo insurance of a minimum amount. We've talked about 100 to 250, whatever it is, that your maximum liability is no greater than that amount, but you put whatever it is in there. That, you know, if there's a dispute, if you want to have arbitration rather than have to go to court, you put that in there. Certainly that they're going to pay your freight charges, I'd say no more than 30 days without offset. That means that if there is a cargo claim, they don't get just to be judge and jury of the cargo claim. And then with respect to any potential claim, we tie it down to the federal statute and the federal rules, which keeps you away from these strange provisions in which the broker says he wants to have the sole discretion whether or not to reject, crush, or dump the goods. And then, you know, there's a little page there where you have got information with your accessorials. As we talked earlier about, you know, maybe 2 hours of free time and then, you know, $75 an hour, whatever you want to put in there, so that in two or three pages you have got the guts of what you need to take care of 95% of the problem. And if you look at the book, I think you can quickly make work out of these long broker carrier contracts. Frankly, they're the bane of my existence. I spend a large part of my life reading these things, and the words are just absolutely unnecessary. I looked at one today for a major department store, and they wanted my client to waive the right of salvage. They wanted to be able to decide if the load was delivered late that they could reject the load, and that we would pay 60% of retail for it. On and on and on, and I ended up telling my client, you know, don't they understand that the market's hardened and you don't need the business as much? And, you know, sometimes I think increasingly these people that take the hard line are going to have a hard time finding trucks.
I got a quick question. I want to jump
on the road that ought to be fair. I have for years had clients that had both a brokerage and a carrier operation, and I've tried to say to them, listen, let's don't come up with a broker-carrier agreement that you wouldn't sign as a carrier. Let's make it even-handed and simple to do. And, I think there's a real basis for particularly small carriers to work with one another on a level playing field. And, you know, that's what I would add to them.
I want to jump in real quick and just kind of horseback off of that just a smidgen there. If you're dealing with a direct customer, if you go get a direct customer and you don't have the contract in place like we're talking about right now, but if everything would a standard bill of lading, if it's on a standard bill of lading, if I'm understanding it correctly as far as a standard bill of lading is concerned, it's actually a contract as well. Would that suffice to cover you on some things? Or
well, again, on my website, there is a webinar on 61 things that are in a standard bill of lading. A standard bill of lading does cover a whole lot of things that you can incorporate by reference very easily, and using a standard bill of lading is a great idea. And that's the claims rules, times for filing claims, salvage, how to dispose of that. There's a lot of rules of the road that are there. What is not in a standard bill of lading are the accessorial charges, are the base rates, is interest and attorney's fees. And if you look at the bill of lading, it says on its front, received subject to written contracts, if any, otherwise subject to carrier service terms and conditions, a copy of which is available upon request. Now, that gets us back to that second issue that I mentioned earlier, which is even small carriers should have service terms and conditions that augment the bill of lading. Although the law says it only has to be made available upon request, you know, I advocate that people don't just hide it in the bottom drawer, but put it on the website so that you don't get in that situation. Somebody earlier mentioned the shipper said, well, I didn't know. You know, if you've got it on your load confirmation sheet or on your email that says, and a lot of my clients have on their email for Hank's Trucking Service Conditions, see www.hankstrucking.com. So they get that in front of the shipper at the time of booking. If they're going to just send him a rate sheet that says Charleston, South Carolina to Nashville, Tennessee, one truckload of books, you know, $1,000, it says subject to service conditions found at. So, you know, you really need to kind of tie service conditions and or contracts together with the bill of lading. But getting the bill of lading incorporated takes care of those 62 little things that can get left out. One of them is, you know, the filing of a claim, the duty to mitigate. The bill of lading, for example, says that the carrier is required to provide reasonable dispatch only, not in time to meet any particular market or sailing. And, you know, that's an important concept because all too frequently you'll have a broker insisting that you've got to be there to make a market at 6 o'clock in the morning and then wants to reject the load. Well, if you've got a bill of lading incorporated, you've got what's reasonable dispatch. You don't have to provide him jet plane service at an everyday low rate.
So, all right, Kenny, I stole a little bit of your time. So you got a follow-up, Kenny, or are you good?
Well, just I want to get the name of that book again. I know you said the website is transportationlaw.net. And what was the name of the book?
Yeah, if you go to transportationlaw.net, you can see that over on the right-hand side, there's probably a place to order the book. And if you have any trouble, just shoot me an email, and my office will take care of it for you. But I think transportationlaw.net is pretty easy to remember, and you can see a good number of the things we've talked about tonight. I've got, you know, free things on there for, but the book I think is $30.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very
great
much.
Great resource. Yes, thanks, Kenny. I'm going to jump over here. Let's grab Jim in Kansas. Jim, you're on with Mr. Seaton.
Okay, thank you, Rico. Thank you, Mr. Seaton, for being on there. That's great advice I'm hearing. I wanted to ask you, Northland Insurance, if you got it, I mean, can you give me, I know you don't really like to bash insurance companies, but I've heard
good
things
Northland.
About
Northland. I do.
Okay. Yeah.
Northland is one of maybe half a dozen that I've had very good luck with. One of the things I like about Northland is their cargo policy doesn't contain a bunch of Swiss cheese.
Right,
so,
and
I
actually
mean, they provide good coverage, and I think they make a good market for small carriers.
Yeah, no, a friend of mine got some quotes, and they were by far cheaper for better coverage and a cheaper rate at the same time. So I just wanted to see if you heard anything good or bad about it.
Yeah,
them, so
I don't. Well, I don't know. You know, I'm not touting Northland necessarily. So, you know, don't go out and say, hey, you know, if you're plugging it, but you mentioned them. I don't know about their rates, but you know I do know they do have good coverage. I think one of the things I will say that it's important that you not buy insurance just based upon who gives you the cheapest premium. You need to look at the policy and ask for these coverage issues. But in terms of my dealings with Northland, representing carriers and shippers, they have they've had a good honest claims policy, and I haven't had any difficulties with the cargo policy.
Well, can you tell me if I hear these $100,000 limit or $250,000, does it even raise the premium that much? I mean, it seems logically it would raise it more than double, but does it in reality, if I wanted to make sure my customers were covered, should I have an accident, I would feel bad if their stuff wasn't, you know. It could run a small manufacturer out of business if they lost the whole, you know. I was curious too if that cargo is insured on their end.
Yeah,
anyway,
but see, the other thing you got to realize is, and I do think there's a tendency to move up from 100,000 to 250, but I've traditionally said that 100,000 is kind of where the limit is. You got to realize that most shippers have property insurance. So most of them have got their own insurance, and what you're really meeting is you're meeting their subrogated insurance company who's then trying to beat up on your company. So it's not that you're leaving your shipper without coverage. It's a dueling battle between insurance companies. So don't necessarily feel bad for your shipper if he knows the limit of liability. The interesting thing about cargo insurance is, if you're hauling from Canada, in Canada, the limit of liability by statute, unless you otherwise agree to it, is $2 Canadian per pound. If you're hauling out of Mexico, there virtually is no cargo liability. In the air freight industry, it's typically 50 cents a pound. So the limits of liability in the trucking industry are really all over the lot. Although the Carmack Amendment, which is the statute we have, says it's for the full actual value, most sophisticated shippers expect their cargo to be limited. For example, would you believe that if you haul a used machine to any of the regular route carriers, their limit of liability is 10 cents a pound?
Good, nice.
10 cents a pound. And the reason for that is, positions, they don't know whether or not the machine worked when it was put on the truck, so they limit their liability to such a negligible amount that the sophisticated shipper knows if he's shipping a used machinery, he just got to get his own insurance.
Right. Well, Mr. Seaton, we got about 2 minutes left in the show. Wanted to use these last 2 minutes to give you an opportunity to plug anything that you got. Wanted to give everyone the opportunity to know. Just show our appreciation for Mr. Seaton. If you have any questions or anything like that, if you need any contracts, simple contracts, something like that drawn up, I'm pretty sure he would love to be able to assist you. So in order to do that, Mr. Seaton, I'm going to give you the floor. You got the final.
Yeah, well, I do make available the website. You know, I think it's important that, small carriers have an opportunity to compete. I don't like what I see going on in terms of the government increasing regulation and making it more difficult for small guys to compete. And you know, if you look at some of the things that I'm writing and doing in my old age, it's really trying to push against some of the regulatory overreach that we currently are experiencing. Maybe in a subsequent time we'll get a chance to talk about things like the hours of service or some of the new gimmicks the government's coming up with to make it more difficult to make an honest dollar. But I feel like it's a pretty crucial time. I think if you want to get in the industry and stay in it, you're going to make some money now, but you're going to have to fight. You're going to have to fight the government and competition to do it. And, you know, with that, I've enjoyed this. I told Rico I'll be happy to do it, on future events. It seems as though we barely get started on one topic when we do it. But I think you guys have got some thoughtful questions, and, it's tough to run a small business with all the issues you've got. If I can be a resource, I'm happy to do it. So I guess that's about it, Rico.
Would you just want to, we got a few more seconds left, you want to go ahead and we know the transportationlaw.net. You got a phone
yeah,
number that they
yeah.
may be able to follow up on?
Yes, it's transportationlaw.net. You can call 800-338-8883. As Rico knows, I'm general counsel for NASTC, the National Association of Small Trucking Companies, which offers a whole bunch of services that, you know, are really designed to practically help you. That's certainly an excellent research for a resource for fuel discounts, for everything from how to deal with the sleep apnea question to insurance issues that go beyond what I do as a lawyer. So I think it's important that you partner with people who can provide you goods and services. And that's an additional recommendation I'd make. I know that Rico knows those folks well too.
Yes, sir. We definitely recommend NASTC. Mr. Seaton, we're finished with the recording session. The recording has stopped, but I got a couple of callers that still got questions. Got three more calls. If you got time, I don't know what
you're
saying.
Sure, I'll be happy
like,
to take them.
All right, well, let's see. Let's try and grab here. Caller in the 214 area code. I don't have a name on you. Are you there? Hello, caller. All right, well, we're going to try to go. We'll go to another one here. Let's see. I got a caller in the 803 area code. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right.
How are things in South Carolina?
Yes, sir. Mr. Keaton, hi. How do you pronounce your name? Keaton? Can you spell that for me?
It's Seaton. It's S-E-A-T-O-N.
Okay. Let's say if a small motor carrier gentleman that has authority started and wants to have, representation on standby. Do you do like what's the word I'm looking for?
You're talking about a retainer or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, I do have some retainers for some larger clients, but, for small guys, I don't insist on a retainer. If you've got an issue, give me a call. I'll be happy to help you with it. If there's no conflict of interest, that means I represent the guy on the other side. You don't have to pay me any kind of standby fee.
I think I caught you. Your phone number is 800-338-8883. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the 800 number from my office. Yes.
Okay. And can you spell your name for me again, please?
It's S-E-A-T-O-N, like the deep blue sea and a ton of it.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. All right. Well, I got that. And you say you're a general counsel for NASTC. Because I just recently joined NASTC within the last 4 or 5 months. No, within the last 4 or 5 weeks. So wonderful program. But I came in on the last tail end of the show, so I better have a chance
yes.
to join in. And so.
Well, great. Maybe I'll see you in Nashville in November with their annual convention.
Well, I look forward to be there. So it's transportationlaw.net.
Yes, that's right.
Right. Right. And we got more call, Mr. Seaton, and we'll let you get on to the rest of your evening. We appreciate you being so gracious
okay,
with
sure.
your time. Caller from the 219, you're on with Mr. Seaton.
Hey, Mr. Seaton, how you doing, Rico?
Hey, good.
We're doing well. What can I do for you?
Well, my name's Tom Simpson. I run EAS Trucking out of Indianapolis, and I have a question. I run a four-system camera system on my truck at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And records. Now, I don't just throw videos up on the internet or nothing, but what I'm trying to do is when I do deal with a driver that's acting wrong and stuff, I try to go to their safety manager. Now, my question is if I send that safety manager a video, aren't they compelled by law to deal with that driver and make sure they're doing right? Or is that strictly a moral issue?
Well, I mean, what kind of when you say doing right, what do you have in doing? Peeing on your tires?
Maybe a driver driving down the road cuts you off. He's in the far left lane, and all of a sudden he just goes left to right. Maybe he's drifting in the lane. I had one the other night was just tailgating me, and I talked to him on the CB a couple of times. I said, "Hey, dude. Any reason you're so close?" He said, "Because yeah, I'm drafted, man. I'm trying to save fuel." And I said, "Well, don't do it on the back of my trailer, you know." So I just slowly slowed down, but you could see how close he was. And then when I slowed down about 53, he finally went around me. And when he did, he kind of came back like he was going to hit my hood, and I just moved over my lane and held the right lane, fog line on the right line, and, you know, if he would have hit me, I know it would have been his fault because I didn't do nothing to instigate it. He was tailgating. I slowed down. He finally went around me, then he was trying to show that he was mad by aiming at my truck, and I'm just saying, if I send a safety director a video like that, aren't they compelled by law to do something, or is that strictly, it's up to them to do the right thing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would think they're compelled by good sense. You know, I guess the question is, that idiot out there on the road is their responsibility if he had hit you.
Correct.
I don't know of anything that says that he's required to respond to a whistleblower or to get back to you in any event. But if he didn't dress down that guy with road rage, then he doesn't deal with him in his own peril. You know, I mean, hopefully he's not going to be back on the road hitting you.
Yes,
but,
sir.
I sure can't imagine any safety director blowing off something like that. I mean, you know, we've got all these people that have all the back of trailers, how am I driving, call, whatever it is. And I think that's
because most
safety directors are actually trying to get the accidents off the road before they happen. But I don't. To answer your question, I don't know of any law that says that you've got to respond to a public inquiry concerning a driver.
Now, when I mean reply, I don't mean call me back. I just mean to deal with it. I don't mean to call me back and say, hey, I talked to this guy. This is what we did. I just mean, you know, someone's calling in.
I guess the other question is, there's no way to hold that safety director accountable. At this point,
right,
you don't know whether he fired the guy, told him good job, you should have run him off the road. Because,
gotcha.
I mean, you know, there's no way to log it in. It's not like you could, I don't really think a citizen's arrest. I mean, I've heard about that. But, I mean, there's no way to hold that driver accountable other than do what you did. And to assume that the safety director is going to take appropriate action on what he deems to be appropriate.
Okay.
Okay?
Scary.
All right.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you. All right, Mr. Seaton, I appreciate that. That wraps up most of the calls that we had in queue. We still had quite a few people on the line, but
this is fun and this is easy. Give me a call sometime in the future, and we'll do it again.
Yes, sir. We'll look forward to try to maybe get back with you sometime next month.
All right, that'll be great.
All right, thanks.
Enjoyed it, Rico. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for the time.